Welcome to Health Hats, empowering people as they travel together toward best health. I'm Danny Van Leeuwen, a two-legged, cisgender, old white man of privilege, living in a food oasis who can afford many hats and knows a little bit about a lot of healthcare and a lot about very little. Most people wear hats one at a time, but I wear them all at once. We will listen and learn about what it takes to adjust to life's realities in healthcare's Tower of Babel. Let's make some sense of all of this. Recently, I asked my neurologist, why am I receiving $100,000 a dose infusions for my multiple sclerosis? What if I don't take this ridiculously expensive drug? I'm a nurse, so I have a health background, and he explained it well for me. Well enough that I understood most of the pieces of what he told me, but I didn't understand all of it together. I had Googled the infusion once, but haven't retained much of what I read. But I trust him. I'll take the next dose. I'm sort of learning. And I'm sort of deciding, am I leading? As CEO of our health teams, we manage, we lead, and we decide. I'm on a mission to explore the nuances of this way of thinking about self-management in our healthcare. I'm delighted to be speaking with my friend and colleague, Jan Oldenburg. Jan is a nationally recognized thought leader on personal health engagement, focused on transforming healthcare and the physician-patient relationship through digital tools. Jan has been an editor and author of several books about personal engagement. I'll put a list of those in the show notes with links. Jan was co-chair of the HIMSS Health Information Management Systems Society Connected Health Committee, where we met in 2012. Jan introduced me to the Society of Participatory Medicine, SPM, where she is now a board member. Jan and I collaborate on the SPM Governance Committee. I hope to further explore with Jan the decision-making aspect of being CEO of your health. I started this chat with Jan several weeks ago when I asked for her thoughts about some work I'm doing that's funded by the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, a federal agency. I'm serving as a patient expert on the project to help patients and clinicians make better decisions together. Much of what I do is translating academic and bureaucratic ease into language I can understand, and share that with interested lay people in my network, like you. Jan responded with thoughts about a summary I sent out on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Several times in this chat, I will break in to explain stuff that I had to look up. We started by talking about citizen expertise and professional expertise.
How is it that people make good choices about their health care? Let's not say good choices, informed choices that work for them, and that they make good use of experts and helpful people around them.
Well, and that they know how to tell who's really yes. an expert, right? I'm in a Facebook discussion with an old friend from high school who is totally on this anti-vaxxer kick.
Okay.
And about, you know, what's delivered together in the MMR and that it should be separated and that Wakefield is perfectly credible and but misunderstood. And then, of course, she's got other people who then pile on, right? And I seem so far to be the lone person saying, no, right?
Interesting. Yeah.
And this is somebody who She's actually very bright.
More in the show notes about Wakefield and the anti-vaccination movement. Wakefield was a discredited research study claiming to show a link between vaccination and autism.
I think that what you're describing is emotion versus facts. And I think that they're very different frames. And I don't think that we are very good at bridging those frames of thinking about stuff.
There was a tweet chat for physicians the other week. And one of the things that came up is, and this is was evident in my interactions here, is that these are people who think they are basing it on research.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So they are bringing up all of these sources that disprove or prove that they think that they are using facts and data and logic, but it started in the wrong place and they don't, and then they're in the forest.
Okay. So this is not besides the point at all, because I think that people make choices either from inertia. Mm-hmm. This is what I've done. This is what I'll keep doing, mm-hmm. not necessarily mindfully. Mm-hmm. But they also make choices based on so many different things.
Yeah.
And when I listen to people talking, they talk about people's preferences. They talk about people's goals. I think that all of those things go into how people make choices. And the choices that they make with their clinicians are probably only a very small proportion of the choices that they make, even about their medical care.
Well, and I totally agree with you. And I also think that we talk the language of choices and goals, but don't really process the reality. And so, you know, I often find myself saying, you can't dismiss people's health choices as irrational because they're rational to them.
Yeah.
You don't know what context they're making them in. So I might be somebody who prefers non-pharmaceutical options. Actually, I kind of am, right?
Yeah.
And we're kind of okay with that unless it interferes with the treatment we think you should get. Or we tend to frame the person's goals as our goals for them, as opposed to the person's goals for him or herself.
Right. So I think in this initiative that the goal for ARC is that people collaboratively make decisions about medical care with their clinician based on the best evidence. So they're looking at what are the tools that are available. And when they think about tools, I think they think a lot about electronic tools. Mm-hmm. My drumbeat is the most used tools are paper and pencil. And the next most used tool that I'm aware of is Excel. And that's also pretty rare. Then I think the next tool that's prevalent, which is probably more than Excel, and maybe even more than paper and pencil, is social networking.
It's early for many. Or as Susanna Fox talks about, there's also the waistband tool. Do my favorite jeans fit anymore? Clues you get about where you are from how your body is in the world.
The two areas that I'm interested in talking to you about The first one is, how do you recognize a good tool? And the second one is, how do people learn about their health? You and I are really unusual. We are the CEO of our health. That's just the way it is. Right. And the kind of help we get is from people helping us be the CEO. And then on the other end, there's probably people who never go to the doctor and never try to engage. Then there are people who just give me a pill, tell me what to do. And then everything in between. And there's probably the same range for clinicians.
Yes.
And there's different ages and there's different power dynamics.
Yep.
Just so many things. And so it seems to me that even though I'm saying those as two different things, they're really intertwined.
Yeah, I think that's true. Mm-hmm. I had this revelation when I was writing Participatory Healthcare, and I interviewed a woman who is a friend of mine as one of the patient stories, and she had the experience of getting Guillain-Barré, and not as a result of, you know, anything clear. I think it was probably a respiratory infection.
Okay, I'm sorry. She got what?
Guillain-Barré, you know, the paralysis thing, right? Yeah. Often associated with flu vaccines.
Guillain-Barré syndrome. Guillain-Barré syndrome, GBS, is a rare neurological disorder in which the body's immune system mistakenly attacks part of its peripheral nervous system. That's the network of nerves located outside of the brain and the spinal cord. GBS can range from a very mild case with brief weakness to nearly devastating paralysis, leaving the person unable to breathe independently.
She wasn't a terrible diagnosis story. Her doctor recognized it right away, sent her immediately to a neurologist who immediately diagnosed it and told her, you're going to need to be in the hospital. You need to be hospitalized. And she said something on the order of, I can't. My husband's out of town. I've got a 2-year-old. This is a very take charge person, probably one of the most take charge people I know about everything. He said, well, okay, but this is going to happen. Basically, you're going to end up in the hospital. So she left and she went home. And that night she couldn't even get her 2-year-old to bed. She couldn't carry him up the steps. And she ended up going to the hospital in the middle of the night. It was one of those occasions when, as she talked about it, it became clear that even this most take charge of humans at that point needed her doctor to be more take charge.
Yeah, right.
Than he was. And she couldn't convey that.
Right.
But he sort of needed to be able to figure that out, you know, about either by providing more information that would help her make a better decision or giving her scenarios about things that could happen. Mm-hmm. I always think about that in terms of what I would write about how I would want to be dealt with might not be the case in every situation if you ask me to write it down. So there's always situational leadership that has to be kind of operative in these settings as well.
I think that's interesting. One of the reasons I like to think about CEO of my health is I feel like it's a leadership dilemma. Yeah. I've spent part of my career as a boss.
Right.
And I'm a student of organizations, and I'm a student of leadership, and I'm a student of health.
Yes.
And so it's easy for me to think about those things together. I was at the neurologist today, and we have a very good relationship. And I see him as an important subcontractor.
Right.
To me.
Yes. Yes.
But I do leave a lot of decisions to him.
Interesting.
I just have no idea.
Right.
We had a talk about the infusions that I'm taking that cost $100,000 a dose. And I'm thinking, you know, twice a year I have this infusion. And what if I didn't take it? Right. We were just exploring that. And he explained very well.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm making the decision to leave the decision to him.
Right. As opposed to him just assuming that it's his decision.
The only tool that I use with him is the portal.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it's we talk. When I see him, we talk. Otherwise, I have a relationship with him that when I have questions, I ping him and ask my question and he answers them. That's sufficient. Even though I've had gigs to help develop clinical decision support tools for the treatment of multiple sclerosis,
mm-hmm.
I actually cannot imagine he and I using it.
Interesting.
And I'm there because I have a patient perspective and I'm a clinician. That's right. Why I'm an advisor to this project. But I actually can't imagine.
And why is that?
Because we just have the conversation and I don't know. The part that I try to influence is that the tool would theoretically help me before I go to his office so that I'm more intelligent and have thought about those things that might inform the decisions that we have to make about disease-modifying treatment.
Jan is showing me some spreadsheets and graphics that I will include in the show notes.
I want to share some of my data for a second and tell you just a second how I used it
Most
recently. Okay, this is old data, right? Because I don't actually need to track this anymore to this degree. But when I first developed asthma, I have very non-standard asthma. And I was trying to figure out what the hell it correlated to. So this is a year's worth of data, actually taken 3 times a day. So this is peak flow data, right? And the yellow is all of the time I was on prednisone.
Okay.
And what I was trying to figure out actually was why sometimes I would get to my yellow zone and fall off the map and just go down the hill, and sometimes I wouldn't. So I did this for 3 years, and then I tracked my average prednisone by a year, the days on prednisone by a year, the total prednisone I took by year, my peak flows across those years, and the fact that after I had sinus surgery, everything got better. From there on, that's the yellow after sinus surgery.
Wow.
I have a new pulmonologist at BCU. He's a great guy. And I was talking about how I'd done this because I think there should be a tool in there. And he was just like, oh my God, you actually have data that tells a story. Mm-hmm. Most of the time when people track their data, I just get slips of paper or entries. I don't get it in any form that allows me to understand what story it's telling me. And it's both the patient and the doctor need visualization. They need correlations. They need things that are suggestive of what's going on rather than that it's just data points. And most people don't know what would be useful, and most doctors don't know how to describe what would be useful.
So are you telling me this story because the opportunity for electronic tools might be to anticipate the kinds of data that are important to use to tell a story so that a person could collect data about themselves or their devices could collect, and then there's an algorithm to turn that into a story?
Yeah, that helps you tell the story. And the other part, I think, is that most of the time when you're using an app, the only thing it really does is nag you about either recording your data.
Important but limited feature.
Totally limited. And, I think we all respond to nagging about as well as we did when our mothers did it and we were 13, right?
Right. Or our spouses or whatever.
It's all true,
right.
Yeah.
Right.
But the power of it potentially is to suggest correlations and possible actions. I.e., I notice that your peak flow is always lower when the humidity is above 90%. Or perhaps there's some action you can take. Or yes, your asthma symptoms, your lowered peak flow correlates to pine pollen, but not to grasses.
Away from that.
Oh, we're so far away. But it is the potential.
It is.
What technology does best is find those hidden patterns that you can't see.
Okay.
And, yeah. Or it's at least one of the things it does well. And some of them may be just noise in the system. It may totally be noise that, the temperature or the humidity has an impact.
Okay.
But maybe not. So it's suggestive. It's not determinative, but right, suggestive.
Right.
But one more thing.
Yeah.
And I did put some notes in your document, by the way. But
thank you.
The other thing that I think is easy and we miss the boat on so much, it so drives me crazy that it's not a portal requirement. So they did the info button for clinicians inside of EHRs. Mm-hmm. But they didn't do the info button for patients.
Right.
And providing contextual education.
Yes.
When I am looking at my lab result or my, even the conditions I'm named with or the procedure, give me in that moment.
Right.
Something to educate me about.
Jan is referring to an info button, formally described by the HL7 standards as the content-aware knowledge retrieval info button specifications provide a standard mechanism for clinical information systems to request content-specific clinical knowledge from online resources. Phew. In English, you click the button with an eye on it to open a window with further information that's important to you. The record may say MMR vaccine, and the button returns measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine given to children in doses during the first years of life.
I think patients have the same dilemma that clinicians do, which is they're drinking dirty water of information with a fire hose.
Yes.
Even my neurologist, who I love dearly, uses open notes. Mm-hmm. And I've had to have this conversation with him that his notes don't help me a bit because I can't figure out by looking at his notes, am I better or worse? Am I progressing or aren't I?
Critical question.
Critical question. And that's not in there. I have said that to him, and then he said, oh, just look right here. And there's this scale. And he said, see, over the years I've seen, you've gone from this to this to this. That's progression. But I had no idea. And I'm a nurse and I'm an informaticist. And it was just a bunch of noise.
Wow. It's a great example.
And now a quick break to hear about our sponsor, Abridge. I see many clinicians on a regular basis, way too many. I'm appalled at how little I can remember when I get home. My wife asks me, what did she say? What about this medication or that test? I'm happy to remember half of it. To help me remember everything, I downloaded a new smartphone app called Abridge. Now, when I talk to the doctor, I ask if it's okay to record our conversation. Nobody has said no yet. I push a big pink button to record, and after I'm done, the transcript from our audio appears. Not the whole thing, that's too much, but sections around medical keywords like fatigue, pain, tests, exercise, meds. Now when I'm done, I can share my visit with my wife, and she can listen to exactly what the doctor said. Abridge was created by patients, doctors, and caregivers. Check out the app at abridge.com. ABRIDGE.com. Or download it on the Apple App Store or Google Play Store. Record your health conversations. Let me know how it went.
What are the key pieces that we're talking about? So you've said just-in-time information that tells a story within the context of either my life or my medical condition, with the opportunity to ask questions, either way.
Yes, I also had the sense that many of the things in that document was trying to be two-way, right? It was trying to both give the patient an opportunity to learn and share, but it was also trying to get information from that patient, right? I'm not completely sure that you can serve two masters here.
Ah, say more about that.
Well, and I'm not sure you can't, right? I at least have the fear that in focusing so much of the attention on, you know, being a part of the fire hose, right? That it continues the approach, perspective, et cetera, that is what we do to patients, which is all about a kind of one-way transmission. Mm-hmm. This is all the stuff you need to know. This is all the stuff we want you to know. Here it is consolidated, maybe, but it's still sort of from us to you. And I have this picture, possibly completely unrealistic, that we could actually do care planning truly collaboratively. That it's not just, okay, we're going to assemble all the care plans from your different doctors, but we're actually going to give you a way of constructing your own out of all this noise. You touch on it. It's a minimum standard. You put care plans in from everybody. Highlight where there are conflicts, right? Highlight where Dr. A is saying X and Dr. B is saying Y.
Right. Or it costs $100,000 a dose and I don't have insurance.
Well, there's that. Yes, exactly.
A different kind of
test. When we first did cost estimation at Kaiser, because Oregon required it, the mantra from leadership was, okay, that's fine if we have to do this for patients, but for God's sake, keep it away from the doctors. They don't have to know this and they don't want to know this. And within 3 weeks of our launch, the doctors were screaming, saying, you have to give me access to the same tool you give to my patients, because they walk in here with this data I don't know, and I don't know where they got it, and they're asking me for advice based on the cost, and I have no clue. So if you really focus on what patients want and need, I'm not sure that the things we think they should want and need are the same things.
Oh, absolutely. I'm co-chair of a work group that's looking at the critical features of a patient-facing app focusing on pain management. My influence as co-chair is, as a patient, if I could have four features, the list that I shared with you that you've been commenting on is sort of the let's include everything approach, which I find overwhelming.
Everything but the kitchen sink.
And that's okay. It's good to have an inventory. But I'm a practical person. My brain can't handle everything. And so...
Nor can anybody else's.
And so hence, I'm interested on whatever group of experts that I'm working with, what do we think is a bottom line, these four things? You've already talked about one that's a feature that turns data into a story, whether that's a dashboard or something. We've talked about vetting what we think is evidence. Not that you've said those are the most important things.
Right. But about contextual education, which is so simple and should be required.
Of what we've talked about, that's clearly the easiest.
Oh my God, exactly. It kind of is so falling off a log easy, right?
Yeah. Right, okay.
Kind of no excuse. We've also talked about this whole concept of it really is my care plan, not the one you want me to have.
Yes.
Right? I mean, if we really understood how to do that and how to understand my values in a different way than we currently do and get to them, we'd really get some of the things that end up being barriers, which is either it's about that I worry so much about the expense of the medications, or I really just hate putting this foreign stuff in my body.
Right.
Or I hate X side effect, or...
Right. You can't mess with my sleep, or you just can't mess with my pathological optimism.
Yes, exactly. Right. Or, you know, my husband had a heart attack at 46, and I'm an educated consumer. Mm-hmm. And I'm so friggin' confused at this point about what we should be eating. I am.
Right.
Is it low fat? Is it high fat? I mean, I get eliminating sugar except for the wine. Right. But can I eat bread, or is it low carb, or is it high natural carb? It's just
okay, so that makes a plan. A plan is, what do I do next? Who's my team?
And let me be able to say, okay, how much evidence is there behind this fad? Mm-hmm. And how do I interpret it? You know, like, what's really going on with keto, or, you know, what's going on with whatever else? Anyway, something that gives me, doesn't do the assessment for me and give me the answer, mm-hmm. but gives me resources to the degree I say I want them.
Mm-hmm.
To sort through noise. You and I might be asking really different questions.
Sorting through noise, that's a soundbite that works. There is so much noise.
So much noise. And half the time, you know, people assume I know nothing about asthma, say. So they want to give me the basics. No, I friggin' don't need the basics. I want to ask sophisticated questions and get sophisticated answers. Right. But on some new thing I get diagnosed with, I may be at a neophyte stage and I really want the basics there.
Or today I'm in pain And I just can't hear anything.
Yeah.
I need to record this.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
when I
go
home to my wife, I can share it with her and then listen when I'm not in pain.
Right.
And think about, what did the doctor say?
Yes. And what does this mean?
Mm-hmm. What does this mean to us? And what are our questions now that I don't feel like crap and I have somebody with me who I trust?
And I actually can re-listen outside the stress of the visit. Mm-hmm.
So maybe that's another one.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing that I've been really plugging is this idea of 24/7 being able to
get
answers to questions. My first neurologist, right away, he said, you're going to have a ton of questions. I'm signing you up for the portal. I want you, whenever, anytime that you have a question, I want you to ping me and send me your question.
What a gift.
And he said, I will probably get back to you within a few hours unless you send it at 1 a.m. But you should still send it at 1 a.m. And then he had three stock answers. Oh, get over it. if it's still tomorrow, let me know. Or
okay. Yeah.
We need to talk right now.
Wow.
I've told people that and they go, oh, he's so rude. Oh, get over it. But I loved it because I'm a worry wart. And I just, all these things were happening. Is this the MS? Am I having a relapse? It was 90%, oh, get over it. And then I just got over it. And then it was a few times it was, let me know if you still feel it tomorrow. And mostly I didn't. And one time it was, we need to talk. And I had to go get steroids.
Yeah.
I think that 90% of people's questions are predictable. So why not have a frequently asked question algorithm as part of the website, the portal, whatever?
Do you know what they've done with HealthLoop? Are you familiar with HealthLoop? My information is probably a couple of years out of date in terms of they've probably gotten better at this.
Mm-hmm.
And they started out with post-surgery and have extended from there. They basically said, okay, first of all, we need information to know how somebody's doing, and we don't really want to have to call them every day. We have just a couple questions to ask you. But what they did also was they fed people just with an email. Here's what happens to many people on the third day after surgery.
Ah.
Being X, Y, and Z. Please respond with just 2-3 questions. Answer to us. Them. And it was signed by their doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Because it fed them this, here's what's predictable.
Mm-hmm.
It helped them understand which things were to be expected and which things they needed help with.
Well, I really like that it was push instead of pull.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
That's cool.
Mm-hmm.
See, now I didn't even think about that. Wow.
The other part is that we spend all this money trying to call people to get answers to questions like, you know, is your wound red or is it okay, right? Or they don't come in at the right times. Anyway, so there is something to be said there for exactly that. What are the things that you might expect to be asking? And what does it mean? And what can you do about it, if anything?
Yeah. Oh, man. Oh, there's so much, Jan. All right. I got a few more minutes. I want to talk briefly about this idea of how people learn.
Yeah.
I am not a fan of curricula too much.
Yeah.
Because I think that people learn best, whether they're 3 or 90, when they want to know something.
Yep.
They're looking for answers to their questions. I don't think we're good at that anywhere.
So think about reinventing search, right?
Okay.
I'm going to say things that I know that we hate it when Google actually does it, right? Mm-hmm. But if instead of spitting back to me the entire friggin' universe, let me tell you a little bit about what data sources I'm interested in, mm-hmm. or learn from the ones I actually spend time with.
So that's sort of like what Sarah Krug is doing with Cancer 101, where they look at how do people take in information? Are they readers? Are they listeners? Are they watchers?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Which to me is like sort of the floor.
Yes.
Even though it feels really revolutionary to me that she does that.
It's still the floor. I mean, I work with a woman in Pittsburgh who's got a company called MetaRespond, and they're based off of a patent with Carnegie Mellon. Their most successful one is educating about open heart surgery to date, I should say. They worked with a couple of surgeons on what are all the things that you want people to know, people ask, the concerns, the things you get questions about, and created this whole library of snippets of video with an actor answering those questions.
Yeah.
Then they have a language model that maps kinds of questions to kinds of answers. And so you can now go in, if you're having open heart surgery, and just start talking to your device, and it brings back the right snippets of information. And so it feels like you're having a conversation about it. People have spent like 90 minutes.
What's the name of that again?
It's called MedRespond. The Allegheny Health Networks, I think, did a study on this, a clinical study. People spend an average of 90 minutes working with the open heart surgery model, and the people who did it cost 30% less than the people who didn't.
Oh my goodness, that's monster. Both of those are monster. I mean, I'm delighted when somebody looks at my website for more than 30 seconds.
Exactly.
90 minutes is amazing.
90 minutes is huge. And granted, they're having surgery. They're worried. They're concerned. They're, you know, they're interested.
Right. We homeschooled. And I understand the idea of learning about what my kid is interested in. And frankly, since I'm a selfish person, I looked at what we were both interested in.
Yeah.
And then we went for that. And we designed our learning experience about a mutual interest. Like right now, I see my son and my grandson taking a course in designing video games. He's 11. They've been doing this for a couple years. And he's just learning so much. Finding that.
Yes.
That's the art.
Yes. As opposed to cramming everything down somebody's throat because you're newly diagnosed as a diabetic. You need to know all this stuff.
Well, we are just so not designed for that kind of thinking. And I don't know if it's even reasonable to expect. Because the skills for that all around, I don't know that patients or professionals are really good at that. What do you think of that?
I'm the kind of learner, I'm the kind of obnoxious person who's always asking all the questions in class. Because when I need to know something, I actually need to know it then. Or it distracts me from the rest.
Right, right.
And I don't think I'm actually that unusual, except that I actually say it.
Yeah. Okay. The story that's going on in your head takes our attention.
I've been looking for this stat, so if you happen to know it, I would love it. But it's I'm sure there's a stat out there about how few people understand which drugs they're taking for which conditions and what things they're supposed to do.
You're right. There's a stat.
There's a stat.
There is.
So if you find it, I'm looking for it.
Okay.
Why are you on this medication? Well, He's having some pain issues at that point, but my asthma was also acting up. Is this a diabetes drug or is it a heart drug?
Right. Wow.
And yes, they both probably affected. So just the simple thing of when you get a prescription even, does it say on the prescription bottle why you're taking it? Might say for pain.
Right.
Doesn't say for diabetes.
Right.
So, you know, simple things like that about reinforcing things that help people understand their story too.
Here's that stat that Jan was looking for. 44% of patients believed they were receiving a medication in the hospital that was not actually prescribed. A patient who normally receives a blood pressure medicine, for example, may have thought the medicine was continued when in fact it was not. 96% of patients failed to recall one or more of the medicines that they had been prescribed during their stay, according to the study, which is published December 10, 2009, in the Journal of Hospital Medicine. Thanks to Liz Boehm at Vocera for finding that.
I think we're going to have to schedule another session.
I'd actually like that. The daunting thing about a collaborative care plan is medical professional time and whose responsibility on the medical staff side is it to actually reconcile all these different things? And how do I, when things are coming from all of my docs, do I have to go to each of them individually and say, hey, these two things don't seem like they fit together? Or is there some way that we can design for that to be done for all of us?
And I might not have the bandwidth or the time or the money or however you want to define the bandwidth to do more than four of the things on this care plan.
Totally true.
So there can't be 30.
Right.
Or there could be 30, but there's four on top. And these are the ones you got to do these.
Things loom and recede. My interest level, right? And so it's got to be able to be responsible. Yeah, I was worried about that last month. Don't keep giving me that stuff back. That's resolved. I've dealt with that.
Right.
Now I'm curious about whatever. And the watchword in some fashion is responsive.
Right.
To who I am and what I actually need at this moment in time.
I don't know that we've actually solved anything.
Sadly, no. We've raised more issues than we've solved, haven't we?
Well, what this does to me is, first of all, you've introduced a couple of new things to me. Thank you. And I feel like when that happens, then I start seeing things differently.
Mm-hmm.
So thanks for that.
One more quick thing is that my husband, again, he's got heart disease. He's an intelligent guy. I'm not his caregiver because he can care for himself. But when he found a new doctor, a new cardiologist here, he went in with his story written down, as well as his meds, that said, here's my history. So you've got it in my own words, who I've seen, what they did, what happened. And his doctor was like, oh my God, I've never had a patient write their story before. And there's no place for it in the medical record.
Yeah, that's powerful. Both those things are powerful. Writing the story and there's no place for it.
Mm-hmm.
One of my first national informatics efforts after we met at HIMSS, when I was on a panel with Blue Button Plus. And I was on this panel that met weekly for like 18 months. I advocated for three things. One is that the data set needed to include family caregivers, which I was successful at because it was the operational definition of a field.
Yeah, got it.
There were two other things that were critical. One was what works for me when I'm scared and what works for me when I'm in pain.
Huh.
And in 18 months of weekly meetings, I got nowhere. I could not figure out the hook.
Interesting.
And they, in my work, it was clear that those are the two most important things to people when they go to an unfamiliar medical place like an ER.
Or when I'm in an asthma bout.
Yeah.
I can't talk. I can't tell my story.
Right.
I'm coughing too.
No, what works for you.
Right, but I can't convey it.
Yeah.
And my husband's pretty good at it, but he's not me.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Okay. All right.
On that note, I gotta go.
Yeah, me too. This was fun though. Thanks for inviting me.
Mm-hmm. Talk to you soon.
Yeah, take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
A quick break to plug myself. See the show notes or my website, www.health-hats.com, and click on blog podcast for more information, to subscribe or contribute. If you like it, share it. Thanks. Before this chat with Jan Oldenburg, I thought about learning as learning to be CEO. Now I'm realizing that leaders learn on the job and keep learning. Decision-making takes learning, studying options, seeking advice, taking action or not taking action. We often say that decision-making takes data. Learning takes data. But data can often be noise, even cacophony, sometimes described as drinking from a fire hose. The art is taking a disorganized or overwhelming stream and turn that into a story that motivates actionable information. Jan took spreadsheets of data related to her asthma, analyzed it, and told a visual, actionable story for herself and her physician. Her husband did it differently. Both physicians were amazed. They both found out there's no place in the health record for those stories. What? So leading also means sharing information with the team. Team members come with different backgrounds, skills, and experience, and may come to different conclusions when reviewing data and information. The CEO makes those decisions that are hers to make, or delegates the decisions to her team members. We ended with a discussion about truly collaborative, fluid, up-to-date care planning for you and me. We have so much work to do. We have the right jobs, though, CEO of our health. Thankfully, the rewards can be outstanding.
Follow my blog, podcasts, and resources through my website. See you around the block.